You're listening to the Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal, supported by Bayer Crop Science.
Hello, and you're very welcome to this week's Tillage Podcast. I'm Siobhan Walsh, recording on Wednesday evening, the 10th of April. Coming up, we have all the news from another bumper tillage paper this week. The Crop Protection magazine is out, and we take a look and talk through all that is in that magazine. Later on in the show, I'm going to talk to Stephen Kilday about the potato blight problem. We also chat to Dermot Forrestal of Chagas about working in fields under pressure and what can be done to mine soil and save time. And we have an update from tree agronomists, report from a frustrating fodder and food committee meeting, and talk financials on beans. Okay, first up, the weather. It's still raining, but there is good weather reported to be on the way. So there's a bit of positivity out there, and that's good to see. So Met Éireann are forecasting at the minute that it's going to get dry around the 16th of April or so, and hopefully not too much rain after that until the end of the month anyway, it looks like, and into early May. So hopefully a good spell of weather. Look, I know land is very wet. It still has to dry. So we're looking at kind of the middle of next week before rain stops. So hopefully maybe by the following weekend, people will be going. Get the seed ready and the fertilizer ready anyway. You know, many of you will have crops to spray, and those crops will be walked this week or early next week. So get that spray in store as well and have everything there ready to go so that you're not waiting. We spoke to tree agronomists in the paper this week. It's on page 14 of this week's paper. And, you know, I was amazed by the amount of them that said, look, there isn't stock out on farm yet. So, you know, people need to get their act together on that because it's nearly the middle of April. So it's time to have stock in and to be, you know, to be ready to go and not be in a queue for seed when you need it. Just going around the country, so Brian Riley and Drummond's in North Dublin and Loud. Look, Brian is still positive. They did get 70 mil of rain or over it actually in the past week, but he's still optimistic about spring barley and that crops can still yield well. And in the Northeast, in a particularly bad way, there's a lot of fields that haven't got herbicide, haven't got fertilizer at all yet this year. And I was up around Loud on Monday. You know, there's a terrible mix of crops, like some really good oilseed rape crops and some really bad ones, you know, because people just haven't been able to get out to tree crops. And Brian said, look, land is saturated, but, you know, cautioned against going out with big mixes and tanks that would stress crops. So, you know, while you might need to put your herbicide out in your growth regulator, I know we're all under pressure, but putting all those products in a tank mix isn't going to help your crop. George Blackburn down in County Wexford, he had over 76 mil of rain in the 7 days before I spoke to him on Tuesday. Very little sown down there. Sorry, I should have said basically nothing sown up in the northeast, a few beans. George said he has 100 acres of spring barley and about 250 acres of beans in his region. And George and Brian as well, you know, encouraged people to continue to sow beans because there is that payment there and beans can still do quite well on yield. So, you know, have that insurance in there. Very much the two of them as well, promoting nitrogen going into the seed bed and getting the crop off to a good start and maybe having urea in the seed bed as well to save a bit of money. George saying about 70, 80 units per acre, and he's very conscious of malting barley in that area and is looking back on 2018 and what happened there when the drought came as well. So this is all on page 14. And then Liam Leahy in County Cork for Dairy Gold. Liam gave a great rundown on all the crops, and they're probably doing a little bit better on management down in Cork, I would say. You know, herbicides are complete, nitrogen's up to date. There is some crops of winter barley that still need a T1 fungicide, and those crops will move to a two-spray program to the usual tree that is down that way, and bits of disease present on barley. T0 still to go out on some winter wheat. Early planted rye, Liam said, is looking really well down there. Very little planted. A few early spuds went in last week, or early for this year anyway. Small bits of spring barley down around Middleton, and a few beans gone in as well, but very little planted. All three agronomists are on page 14 of the news pages, as I said. Also in the news pages, Tillage Industry Ireland has said that the sector needs support. They're calling for payments for cereal crops of about €250 per hectare, similar to what the IFA have requested. Also requesting that the protein payment be brought up to where it was last year. If the acreage is at 15,000 hectares, you can read that in the paper, and the full statement is online as well. Now, staying with advice, I caught up with Chagas's Dermot Forrestal on cultivations. Dermot Forrestal, thanks for joining us. Dermot, it's still fairly wet out there as we record on Wednesday afternoon. We had rain here in Laois. It's dried off now, but there's a lot of work ahead, isn't there, Dermot, when that weather, good weather does come?
Yeah, there's an awful lot ahead, Siobhan, and I suppose a lot of decisions to be made too, because we're at a really late stage in terms of the sowing window. So it is very challenging.
Yeah, you're given some advice this week, Dermot. You wrote an article for the crop update. I'm saying it wrong now, but like, you're given some advice on how people can maybe speed things up and make things more efficient. And I'm just reading through it here. It's really good advice, but like, you're basically saying, like, we now know there's probably a 2 week period where we have to get a lot of work done. So what can we do to speed things up? And the first thing you're talking about is ploughing, and ploughing is a very slow process.
Yeah, that's the challenge. Like, I suppose what's really difficult this year is, well, ploughing is always a little bit slower than the other operations, but what's really difficult this year is that there's very little ploughing done in advance. Like in normal years, you know, people will move on the ploughing earlier. Now, I know the use of cover crops and things has delayed that a bit anyhow, but there still would be a reasonable proportion of ground ploughed well before the time that the main sowing would start. That hasn't happened this year because of the weather there. So that really stacks things up in a bad way, if you like, for the start. So it's you know, what can we do? I suppose the main thing to do is try and mobilize every plough, tractor and person that can plough. You know, now that's easier said than done. Are there ploughs out there that aren't in use? And like, there may and well be, but I think the bigger challenge there is going to be the labour to do that, because as I say, it is a slow operation and it is going to tie up people. But certainly, I suppose people should think, you know, are there people out there with ploughs that are not using them that mightn't themselves be available? People who may have, you know, the rare number of people that might have got the bulk of their cropping in the autumn, that they may have more ploughing capacity and so on. So look, that's just the first thing to do. Whether there's even, you know, in some parts of the country, contractors out there who normally don't get involved in the tillage operation at all, they may have a plough for reseeding and that, can they be mobilised? But again, you're probably competing with slurry and fertiliser for the labour for that as well. But certainly to look at any possibility that's there.
Yeah, so if you're stopping for the dinner, get your daughter or son out onto the plough while you're eating. Keep it going anyway. Dermot, you're also saying maybe plough a bit shallower if that's possible.
Yeah, that's only, I suppose it's really trying to think, can you speed up the ploughing operation? But I suppose that's really only the case, Siobhan, if power is a bit limiting, you know, whatever plough you have on your tractor is using all of its power, there's no doubt if your ground has no reason to be ploughing deep, by going shallower, you will ease the load in the tractor. You will be able to go that little bit quicker, but it's not going to make a huge difference. And some people may, after root crops and that, will probably want to plough deeper, or in headlands that were damaged last autumn, may want to plough a bit deeper. But it's just something to consider that by going a bit shallower, you'll reduce the power requirement. You can go a small little bit faster, but that's going to be a very small piece, really, you know?
Yeah. Okay, you have a controversial bit of advice now in the next thing. I don't know what some people will think of this one, but it's fair enough, I think. So, the headlands, Dermot, what do you want us to do with the headlands?
Well, I'm not going to say I want you to do anything, Siobhan, but what people could certainly look at, and this is an idea, it came through Kieran Collins, actually, a tillage specialist, but the concept is, you know, we're moving to a period where a lot of profitability is going to be very, very marginal for a lot of the crops that we're going to sow in the upcoming window, if it comes. OK, so with that in mind, you know, if you look at the least yielding areas of the field, they're the ones that are going to lose most money, if you like, or be least profitable. And one part of that would be the headlands. OK, so if we decided we actually leave the headlands fallow and just ploughed the rest and ploughed and sowed the rest of the field. That obviously would speed up the work because you're going to have less ground to cover, but you'll get a disproportionate advantage, if you like, because if you're not trying to plough headlands, your headlands for ploughing and for other operations, but particularly ploughing, are the slowest part of the field. Yeah. You know, your output in terms of acres per hour is lowest on that. So yeah, we're looking at, you know, we're asking people to seriously consider, you know, are their headlands going to be profitable? And, you know, then to look at maybe not ploughing the headlands at all. In other words, yeah, but now you'd still want to set up a line and try and do it as neat as possible. But literally when you take the plough to the ground, that's all you're going to sow. And that's all you're going to manage after that. Now, there's a lot to think of. People need to think about rotation. They need to think where they're going to be next year if they leave that part fallow. You know, some people might be moving into, you know, contracted crops next year that might not want to have a, you know, I'm thinking maybe gluten-free oats or something like that. So you'd want to be very careful in making your mind up that way. Your ends, your plough ends are going to be there to be seen and be rough looking. As I say, you would still want to have a straight line end. The one operation that you'll have to match up probably is fertilizer spreading. A sprayer or say tilling and sowing, you can run out the end exactly as you would with the plough, turn and sow again. The fertilizer spreader won't really end properly if you try and end going out and then coming back in. You need to have a cross run to get that part done evenly. So the fertilizer spreader, you would have to create a false headland inside crossing the ploughing, if you like. But it is something it's something to consider. You'd want to consider it carefully with your advisor as well, because it does mean that area probably has to be mapped and designated fallow in your ABIS application. So there's an extra bit of work in doing that. So it's not to be considered lightly. But if you look at it and we're into an area where some of these crops are marginal, it might not be the worst example or the worst thing to consider, at least.
No, absolutely, Dermot. And you did make some valid points, like think about the gluten-free oats and that kind of thing, or a seed crop where you need to have a break crop in before it. But it certainly would speed up the operation. There's probably headlands out there as well, could do with a bit of love and a bit of TLC. So maybe would it be an option to put something in after when you have a bit more time? You know, do you go in with a phacelia or something to try and help the soil?
Yeah, I think you could do that. You could let it just naturally regenerate and, you know, try, and it'll support your traffic, I suppose, during this term better if it's not ploughed, if you know what I mean. You'll do less damage if you're turning on it than if it was. But you could let it naturally regenerate and try and naturally recover. But you could, as you say, go back in and try and put something else into it. But I think this year people are going to be so you know, mindful of their costs.
Yeah, it's another
make
cost,
all of those decisions very, very carefully and be sure they get a return from doing even that operation, if you know what I mean.
Fair enough. Mint hill, Dermot, there's a lot of people out there mint hilling, are doing some form of it anyway. Advice then for those people, they might have to wait a little bit longer before they go out in the plough.
There's a temptation there, I suppose, if you have a disc maybe that you're using for cover crop establishment. I put a board of caution there on using something like that, but there are many people who would use mint till to establish spring crops, but they mightn't quite say this, but they are actually using that more like a plough system. So they're working relatively deep.
A
lot of the guys with malting barley and that, and doing that to dry out the ground, much the same as they would nearly in a ploughing type operation. So what I'm saying there is that mint till machines, if they're available, will get through the work faster, right? Because it's easier scale up with them. Like for most people, the 5-furrow plough is as big as you go. It gets awkward beyond that. But people who are on mint till have bought machines much bigger in capacity than that. Yeah. And they will get through the work quicker. But I think you do need to know what you're at. I would be slow to use a disc in wetter conditions, a disc on its own, because I think you mightn't get the penetration. But if you do, you'll tend to compact a little bit. So normally in this situation, you'd be talking about a machine with tines or a combination of tines and discs and working reasonably deep. There's many people establishing, you know, malt and barley crops with those systems for spring crops and doing it quite well. So you want to mimic what they're doing. So again, if they are in the area, you know, and they're not busy, if somebody had, you know, literally mint tillers in there that have been there from, you know, somebody who's established autumn crops. There's even a few contractors out there who are using equipment like that for establishing grass and with a very little tillage operation. They can be brought into play, because I suppose the example I looked at there was that typically you'd see one man and 200 horsepower often pulling the 5-furrow plow. And if he does that, you know, you might get up to 3.5 acres an hour plowed. Okay. If you put that same tractor and driver with a 4-meter tine and disc, now he'd be fully loaded now in this case, whereas he mightn't have been with the other one. 4-meter tine and disc, he'd be working a bit faster, a little bit more efficient on the headlands. He's probably going to be up to 3.5 hectares an hour, or about 8.5 acres an hour. So you're over,
Isn't it?
So for that man and tractor unit, you're doubling the area that you're going to work. But this is not from, there's, you know, you can't afford to mess with this, Siobhan. And you'd really want to make sure that whatever you type of seed bed you're producing, that it's good. And whatever you have to sow it can work in those conditions afterwards as well.
Yeah, we have agronomists on the paper this week, Dermot, giving some advice. Brian and George and Liam are on from different parts of the country, and they're all saying, you know, the conditions are more important than the date you sow. And I don't think we can overemphasize this. I know people are in a panic now, things aren't sown, but we need the conditions.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. You know, now look, what's going to happen too, Siobhan, and that's probably the next thing to consider, is that when it does dry, you know, it will dry on top, but I think people want to be mindful that it is going to be wet underneath, and you'll be trying to conserve moisture maybe as we move on in time. But I think you want to be very mindful as well that, you know, down in the profile, it's quite wet, and because of that, susceptible to damage. So you're dead right. Conditions are important, you know.
And we don't want to do damage that's going to last either into the next season and the season beyond it as well. Direct drill, Dermot, thoughts on that? And I suppose a thing with direct drill as well, it's become more common in beans now too. And at the tillage conference, it was Kieran and Sheila were talking about beans and getting them in. And maybe as you go later in the season, direct drill isn't maybe the best thing to do. But as you said, it provides speed, and maybe it brings in a contractor to get a bit of work done.
Like. Yeah, but I'd be a bit concerned here on this one, Siobhan. I think you'd want to make sure you have good conditions, and I think you will be waiting with some of those systems maybe longer than if you disturb in advance. And I actually think, you know, that this is not the year to start with a very shallow tillage or strip tilling without any other cultivation or direct drilling. Now, maybe if you're given something, you know, a run of a cultivator beforehand, by all means, use those drills then if they'll work in those conditions afterwards. But I honestly think that trying to work with our really minimal tillage tool late in a spring season is adding to risk in terms of crop establishment and early growth. I think your early growth could be constrained, and this is not a year to have constraints on early growth. So I think I'm being very cautious now, because I think there are people out there who are used to these systems and they'll probably work okay with them. But to take on, to establish, you know, a spring barley crop, for instance, with a direct drill without any other cultivation, you know, at the end of April isn't the time to do it. I'd be very concerned about that. So while I'd be all for using equipment to get through the work quickly, I think the conditions have to be right. And I think a lot of ground that's in conventional tillage is going to need some pre-tillage to a reasonable depth to get it to dry out sufficiently to get good seed conditions for the seed. And I think that's why I'd be very cautious with going that far. So non-inversion is okay. You know, in other words, the earlier thing that we're talking about, tilling with something that will till quite deeply and loosen up. But I think the true direct drilling and that, this isn't the year to start. I think somebody who's at it may be okay, but this is not the year to start.
And that's what we hear from people who are direct drillers. You know, they have a system in place, and getting that system in place with break crops and cover crops is key to being able to use that direct drill. Certainly if you're going in with beans and you do decide to go down that route, you need to make sure you're not drilling too deep, because you know you can't be going to 5 inches with your bean seed at this time of the year.
Yeah, oh, I think what you want with beans is to get them over the ground as quickly as possible. And I think, you know, the reason for sowing deep with beans is really to prevent bird damage.
Yeah,
And
so that
unless
risk is
you're in,
going.
that risk is going because everything is going to be worked together now with this
Yeah.
sort of year. So I think the bird threat should be diluted. So Siobhan, I agree completely. Get the beans in shallow this time, and be mindful too that the time to the point at where you can spray herbicide will be much shorter this year. So if you're putting on your
Yeah.
pre-emerge, you'd want to be on the ball with your beans maybe this year as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Dermot, top tips now for the last minute. What's your top tips for people?
Well, the top tips I would say to people, well, you know, to use the time now well. Like, you know, there's many places, there's going to be a week or two before people are really into
Yeah.
working. Maybe they'll get down in 5 or 6 days, 4 or 5 days in some places, but it might be longer. I
Yeah.
would say go out to your fields. I'd say bring a spade with you, plan the work order. Farmers will
Yeah.
intuitively know this, but this is a different wetting sort of period than we've had. So
Yeah.
fields might be a little bit different. They may have drained in different ways. So go out and look at, there are going to be parts of fields that are going to be left. And it might be no harm to have an idea at this stage what they are, because we can't, you're not going to be able to wait. In some areas, there'll be waterlogged parts that probably won't be sown. So I get an idea
Yeah.
what impact that's going to have on you, and maybe plan your work scheduling. Important. I'd say ensure all machines are ready. Right now, this might seem blooming obvious, but I'd say the wearing parts, if you think, you know, whether it's plowshares or whether it's your harrow tines, that look, I'll get a few acres out of them, but I'll change them mid-season or whatever. Change them now.
Change them
You're
now,
not,
yeah.
you're just not going to, and you can use the other ones again, put them back on. I know that's hardship,
Yeah.
but if you have to get the most out of them, get all your drills as far as possible. If there's calibration involved in that, and even spreading fertilizer, all these things, if you're doing it right, takes time. You could be doing some of that maybe in advance. Look, most people know this. They've probably overdone it already, but still, even to plan out how seed comes to the field and stuff like that, is there anything
Yeah.
else you need to do? Because people, you know, are probably stuck with some, they probably have some seed delivered. They have other seed maybe not on site.
Yeah.
They have some seed on trailers. They never thought they'd have bean seed maybe sitting here so long.
Yeah.
So just to kind of think about that, to make sure that when you get into the field, that there's as little disruption or delay in waiting for the support things.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And I would say to people to keep in touch with others as well, you know, more or less for kind of moral support, but
Yeah.
maybe there's a bit of practical support as well, that people might be able to work together or help one another in areas like that, you know.
I
And
think that's go on.
No, the final thing I was going to say is just maybe from, you know, think of the advisors as well. The you know, the old single farm payment or BIS application, it's getting the busy season for that. So maybe a bit of thinking and planning now might save a bit of time as we get near those deadlines, because everything is running in together, as you can see, Siobhan.
Yeah, we'll still be very busy when that application has to be done. That's great advice, Dermot. And I think really importantly at the end was to keep in contact with other people. And we all have Bluetooth and earphones and everything on our tractors now. So you know, there's no reason when you're out ploughing that you can't ring someone and check in and have a chat about how things are going and things. So that's really important. Dermot, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, Siobhan, that's great. No problem.
Thanks, Dermot. And you can read more from the fields in this week's paper, of course, and from the tramlines. And this week, Conor Keogh is talking to Padraig Connery in Villierstown in County Waterford. He's chatting to Sam Miles on the Keepak Farm in Clonee in County Meath, and Tom Murray in Piltown down in County Kilkenny. And I think anyone who reads those pages will see the wet tramlines, and will also see that farmers, you know, have a lot of sowing and work to do. There's plenty of tillage news across the paper. I attended the Fodder and Food Security Committee meeting on Tuesday, and just astounding, really. I mean, it was very clear from the meeting, all very supportive, that the tillage sector is in a really bad way at the minute, you know, while talking about the fodder situation. And then acknowledging that, look, the poor tillage farmers, that's the way I'm putting it, because that's the way it sounded in the meeting, the poor tillage farmers aren't able to do a thing. You know, they're able to feed their cattle in the sheds if they have the silage. So there was great sympathy in the meeting for the tillage sector. But that sympathy just doesn't seem to be coming across in the payments. So in the middle of that meeting, the minister came on and he announced that there would be a fodder transport measure announced. So if you have silage to transport 75 kilometres or more, you would be paid €40 per bale to transport that silage. So a nice little subsidy. But nothing has come from tillage. Or come for tillage, and people were frustrated, and this came up in the meeting as well. Tierlong came out this week with a package for their milk suppliers, and Bobby Miller tackled that in the fodder meeting as well. He said co-ops and merchants need to come out and support tillage farmers, but the minister hasn't done anything for tillage and said he'll assess the situation again in a week's time. That was on Tuesday he said that. So really unclear what's going to happen, or is any money going to come to the tillage sector at all. Jack Kendy is writing about it on page 2 as well this week, and very strongly. He just said, and he's right, this is no good in 4 weeks' time. You know, the support package needs to be announced now. And he's right in that, because if the industry is predicting we could lose 35,000 hectares of land, the longer this wet spell goes on and people lose confidence, the more land that will be lost. So the sooner, if something is going to come, it needs to be announced now. There was a bit of talk about straw in that fodder and food meeting as well. The ICMSA said that they wanted the straw scheme, maybe tillage farmers still get paid for straw, but that they wouldn't chop straw. So I'm not sure how that would work. But the tillage lobby were very strong on that. Kieran McAvoy had his facts and figures. He said, you know, last year was an exceptional year, which we all know. There was about 4,000 acres, I think it was, not planted or not harvested. About 5,000 acres not baled, and that equated to about 50,000 round bales that weren't available to the market. That was the fodder and food meeting. No money coming to tillage yet anyway. Okay, next up, the Crop Protection magazine. So it's in your papers this week. So if you haven't picked up your paper yet, go out and get it, because the Crop Protection magazine is in your paper this week. Nearly 300 products and their details across the magazine, between growth regulators, insecticides, fungicides, herbicides, and potato products are in there too. We also have a table on glyphosate rates as well. So what else is in it? We have an update on the sustainable use regulations, the latest research and management advice on barley from Tom McCabe, and Tom talking about, you know, the fact that we can still get really good yields in planting barley in April and May. And Stephen Kilday then has contributions on winter wheat, and then of course potato blight as well. And then Ed Straw from Trinity College is talking about pesticide formulations, and very importantly about protecting yourself while you're spraying. So we should all read that. Sprayer testing details are in from the Department of Agriculture. So we have to test our sprayers every 3 years now. So the Department of Agriculture and Chagas have a great rundown on preparing for your sprayer test, and some details on grants and when your sprayer test is due as well. And then a really good grass weed identification guide in there as well from Vijay Vaskar in Chagas. So plenty to keep you going in the Crop Protection magazine. Make sure and get it and mind it and keep it safe for the year. Now, as I said, Stephen Kilday of Chagas is writing about resistance to fungicides and blight in potatoes. And I caught up with Stephen at the recent potato blight workshop at the end of March.
In other words,
Stephen, a very informative workshop there. Thanks for joining us, first of all. So blight resistance, I suppose not new that there's resistance to blight or resistance to fungicides, but certainly plenty of new things going on in blight.
Yeah. So I suppose, look, we've had blight for 175 years.
Yeah.
We've tried to control its use in chemistry for about maybe 40 years now at this stage.
Mm.
And in the last two decades, we've had a suite of new actives, fungicide actives that have come along that have been very, very active. But fungicide resistance is not a new thing in blight. I think phenylamines back at the start of the 80s gave us an indication that actually blight can change, and very, very rapidly.
Mm.
I think what has changed in the last couple of years is that although we've had quite a few actives, they were working very, very well. And in the last, I think, about 3 to 4 years, we've started to see first fluazinam resistance coming in, which was a really stable molecule for about 20 years. Really, really relied upon and very, very good. That came in and clearly demonstrated that blight, again, can change. But in the last 2 years, we've seen CA resistance develop, and more recently now resistance to Zorvec.
Okay, yeah. So our, just for people listening, so our fluazenam is our Revis.
No, I'm right.
Or our Sherlan, sorry. So fluazenam is our Sherlan, and then our CAA
is something like Revis. Okay. And then the oxithiopropylene is the Zorvec.
Yeah, okay.
So these three molecules form part of the program, and they're really important parts of that. But if you think about a fungicide program for potatoes, it's about anything up to 15, 16 applications.
Yeah.
If you lose three of those molecules, it means that all of a sudden you're going to have to put a lot more emphasis on the other guys. So what we really want to avoid is actually losing them. We know that blight populations contain resistance to those. We know that fluazenam is established in Ireland. We've detected CA resistance at a really, really low level.
Yeah.
But we're also aware that actually resistance to Zorvec and oxithiopropylene is in the continent. And really what happens over there tends to make its way over here.
Yeah.
So we need to try and manage to prevent them from getting a foothold so that actually we lose them. At the moment, we can still utilise them and they're very, very effective molecules, but we have to be, how would I say, really careful in how we design the fungicide program so that we don't put them under pressure.
Okay. So you said we're kind of 2 or 3 years behind Europe. So they see resistant strains. Very important then for us to watch it. So really important for people to send you samples.
Absolutely. We don't know what's there unless we can get samples in.
Yeah.
I think. So we have detected the CA resistance, or the strain, which is called 43A1.
Yeah.
We've detected that in Oak Park because we're intensively monitoring Oak Park.
Mm.
I think if we were able to get more samples in from, I suppose, commercial crops from around the country,
yeah,
it would give us a better understanding of what's there. And once we understand, once we know what's there, we can tailor our control programs.
Okay.
Fungicides is only part of that program. We need to know information about what blight is there so that we can actually look at, I suppose, timing of applications of fungicides,
yeah,
varieties that we're growing. All this is all dependent on what blight is going to be coming into.
Okay, so if we get samples in, we can change our management and all that. So if you're taking a blight sample, what do you do? That blight needs to be live anyway, so it can't have been treated.
Yeah. So I suppose that's really, it's a bit of a difficult sort of situation that if you're out spraying a crop and you see a bit of blight, you want to actually get that controlled. You want to get on top of that.
Yeah.
If we can get a sample of that just before actually the spray goes over it, that allows, yeah, us to actually work with that.
Okay.
So what I would say, look, you can contact ourselves in Oak Park if you do have a bit of blight, contact us directly, contact your Chagas advisor. Ideally, we'd like to get a sample of that. Also, if you're an agronomist, if there's an agronomist, yeah, an agronomist doing it, let them know so they can contact us and get us, yeah, a sample of that.
So take that sample live before it's sprayed and post it off or whatever, yeah, or put it in the fridge as soon as possible.
Absolutely. So blight will really destroy plants in about 3 to 4 days.
Mm.
So we want to get that live, but we need to get that to us.
Yeah.
So if it's on a Friday, put it in the fridge. Don't let it go into the post because, yeah, when it arrives to us, it'll just be soup. It'll flow out of the bag.
Okay.
We need to get that leaf.
That's all good advice there. And I like the way you're saying sample it before you spray it as well, because you can't leave that little spot in the field untreated. No.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the parts of a control program. We think of control programs purely as fungicide applications.
Mm.
Control programs start with the seed, making sure that actually, look, you've got good quality seed.
Yeah.
But it moves then from the seed through to where it's going to be grown, the conditions that's going into the ground, actually how the field is planned. Because actually, are you going to be going around a telegraph pole? Will, yeah, the sprayer cover that crop every time? Or is there a potential that actually 1 in 5 applications, there might be a spot that doesn't get it?
Yeah.
If there's a spot of potato in a commercial crop that isn't treated with a fungicide, blight will find it.
Yeah.
And then you have a problem because, yeah, within 5 days, 7 days, it's building up inoculum. A break in the weather, a misspray because of weather doesn't let the sprayer out, it's 1 day. Actually, that then just multiplies up.
Yeah.
But equally, I'd say, look, if a scenario, big fields, tram lines, you know you're going to be travelling over these tram lines, they're going to be getting battered. Actually, do you have to sow that tram line? These are the sort of questions
right,
that come in
that
there.
Far, yeah.
It's a zero sort of risk. We need to,
yeah,
try to manage this as much as possible.
Mm.
So you need to think about that. If there's a part of that crop that may not get sprayed, yeah, then actually I wouldn't be putting it in that part of the field.
Yeah. Well, we've always heard the advice, you know, of monitoring the garden spuds or the volunteer potato. So what you're saying makes absolute sense. Mm. So when we do put the sprayer in the field, mix and alternate, and that will be effective.
Oh, absolutely. I think, as I say, we've got a suite of molecules and different modes of action. We're actually quite fortunate in potatoes that actually there are quite a few actives there. Mm. I think what has happened over the last 3 to 4 years has really focused the mind that actually we need to protect what we have. And the only way we're going to protect those is mixing them and alternating them. Yeah. When I talk about mixing, we're mixing different modes of action.
Yeah.
So you're looking at the label and you're looking at actually what's called the frac group. Mm. So there's a specific group number given to different modes of action.
Yeah.
When you mix, you need to be mixing two different numbers. When you alternate, yeah. you need to be mixing or alternating two different numbers.
Yeah.
And that's really, really important.
And you were displaying those numbers on the screen there today as well, Stephen. And just so... how's this going to work out cost-wise then? So we have to implement it really there's not really a choice, is there? It's going to be more expensive and that's it.
It is going to be more expensive.
Yeah.
It's really unfortunate in that aspect. But I think, look, it's a case of what is the risk?
Yeah.
The risk is that we know those strains exist
yeah.
that are actually potentially going to cause fungicide resistance.
Mm.
And if we don't manage it, actually it'll cost more in the long run.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the simple answer is that if we don't do this, it's going to cost more.
Yeah, it has to be done. Stephen, thanks so much. And people can read more about your research in the Crop Protection magazine this year.
Perfect. Thank you.
Thanks so much to Stephen for joining us. Now, I should say I spoke to Conor Condren of Black Silo. Conor is he works in risk management for Black Silo. Some of you will know Rory Deverill from that company. He caught up with us on the Young Stock podcast earlier this week. So here's a clip.
What we're familiar with here is you sow your crop in the winter or the spring and you harvest it and that's kind of it then for that field. Whereas over there, when I was actually there, they were harvesting soybeans.
Yeah,
and coming like the fields, a 500 acre field is kind of the norm over there. It would even be on the small scale of things, farms that we were on were on average, I'd say about 20,000 hectares that you're talking about.
So if you want to catch that, you'll get it online on the Farmers Journal website or wherever you get your podcast, in the same place where the Tillage podcast is, on your Spotify or iTunes, etc. Now to grain markets. On this week's Tillage Pages, we're looking at April sown beans and whether to plant or not. So this is across the two Tillage Pages. And look, I've done up figures on these. I'm not going to tell you the whole story. You can buy the paper. But as far as I can make out, April sown beans are making sense. I've been negative in what I've done. So I've said, you know, if we get the same area of beans as we did last year, 70,000 hectares, the payment would be 412. Assuming there's no top up to that payment, I've put in a yield of 1.5 tonnes per acre and those beans are making money and will be making more money than a lot of the cereal crops. But look, you can look at the whole rundown and the predicted payments as well on the Tillage Pages this week. Okay, to grain trends now. And look, things not too bad this week. Wheat market's relatively steady and oilseed rape on the move up. So the French oilseed rape price for November... last Friday, just to give you an example, it was at 4.60 and then that was up nearly 10 euro, 9.25 per tonne on the Friday before. And then this week on Tuesday, it closed at 4.61.75. Earlier on today, it had moved up again to 4.65.75. And as I look at my app now on Wednesday night, it moved up again. So it moved up a fiver today, 466.75. So there's a few things going on in oilseed rape, worries around planting in places like Canada, soybean. The soybean harvest is going well in Brazil and that actually caused prices to dip for a while at the start of the week. And so we've information there anyway on the back pages on grain trends in the paper. Should note, malting barley price, that price has, the averaging has started. It started a week earlier than usual or a bit more than a week. But anyway, the price for the first week is 260 euro per tonne. So by the time harvest comes around, there's 10 euro per tonne taken off of that. So that brings it to 250. If you get to stilling, you're back to 260 per tonne. Anyway, look, we'll keep an eye on those prices throughout the averaging season. Now to the weather report, and I have the weather in here from Met Éireann. So Friday will be another overcast day, scattered outbreaks of rain and drizzle. Saturday will be a bright day with a mix of sunshine and showers, most persistent in the north and northwest. Sunday, mostly dry and bright on the start of Sunday, and it'll turn cloudier through the morning and afternoon with showery rain. An outlook for Monday to Wednesday. Monday will be another breezy day with a mix of sunshine and showers, remain on the cooler side as well. And as I look at the rainfall chart, yeah, it's certainly starting to dry up as we go to Tuesday and Wednesday. So a nice bit of rain Thursday, Friday, Saturday, a good bit of rain then on Sunday. I just see 11 mil in the northwest, the southwest, the west, and then 7 mil in the Midlands. Sorry, 9 mil in the west, 5 in the east. Monday is wet in the northwest, and then Tuesday is kind of a mil or zero across the range, and Wednesday not too bad either. So things are brightening up, hopefully, on the weather front. Okay, that's it for this week. Thanks to you for listening. Thanks to Dermot and Stephen for joining us. For Claire, back at base for editing. Until next week, stay safe. Hopefully the weather picks up, and keep the tillage flag flying.
We hope you enjoyed the Irish Farmers Journal Tillage Podcast, supported by Bayer Crop Science. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.